Nuketown Radioactive number 34 for Monday, July 17th, 2006.
Well, folks, welcome to Radioactive number 34. I'm your host, Ken Newquist. And yes, I know it's amazing, but this is the second Radioactive within 2 weeks. July. That goes to show you how much sleep I've been getting, right? July is shaping up to be a great month. Things have been flying along. Everything's really gelling on Nuketown. We have, if you can believe it, 20 users already on the site, and we've actually even had some good comment threads going on. We've had some feedback from folks. People actually responded to Radioactive number 33 saying how much they liked the review of the Battlestar Galactica soundtrack and offering up suggestions on podcasts. In particular, Yazug, one of our new users, recommended the Escape Pod and Voices of Tomorrow fiction podcast, which I will be checking out as soon as I have a chance. I have already listened to Escape Pod, and actually I reviewed it on Nuketown a while back, but I hadn't heard of Voices of Tomorrow, so I've already got it queued up in my, in iTunes, and it is ready to be listened to sometime this week. Something else that we've been talking about on the website is an open thread that I've got called Geek Fitness, which is basically, I have a point with this. I kind of opened up by pointing out that, on the whole, Geek Nation probably isn't the healthiest group of people in the world. I mean, you know, we don't exercise a lot. Our pastimes include gaming, whether it be video gaming, board gaming, whatever. And we don't really have the whole exercise ethic going for us, you know? There aren't a lot of geek softball teams or, you know, geek ultimate frisbee teams. Although I would guess there's probably more geek ultimate frisbee teams than there are softball teams. The whole point is that we just don't do a heck of a lot of exercising, and then we compound that by, you know, getting together with our friends, and what do we eat? Lots of potato chips, Doritos, pizza, gallons upon gallons of Mountain Dew. I mean, I dare say that the healthiest thing that we generally consume on gaming night is probably beer. because, you know, we get some good micro brews, and that's probably got the most wholesome ingredients that you're going to find at the gaming table on any given Friday. So, you know, it got me to thinking. I mean, I know I'm generalizing here, and I'm kind of looking at my own gaming group, and I'm looking at myself and realizing, you know, this isn't necessarily the greatest thing in the world here. I'm leading somewhere with this, because I've had my own kind of physical fitness adventures going on the last couple of weeks, and stuff that I'll be talking about more in an upcoming podcast, but it got me to thinking about, you know, is this a truism? I mean, is this what's actually going on out there? So I thought I would post this open thread and asking people, you know, do they exercise? If they do exercise, what kind of exercise do they do? If they don't exercise, why? You know, are they giving up exercising so they can play World of Warcraft? Which my friend Lance Miller, who will actually be joining me later on in the podcast, pointed out, he actually came up with a term for this, which would be the WoW 15, the 15 pounds you gain when you start playing World of Warcraft, which isn't far from the truth. So anyway, there's an open thread about that up on the site. There'll be a link to it in the show notes. I'm very interested in hearing what folks have to say on this subject. And I'll be putting out my own thoughts and just kind of talking more in depth about the whole topic on an upcoming podcast. I promise not to bore you to tears, guys, because I think this has the potential to be a pretty good conversation. Now, I mentioned Lance. For the first time, I have a guest for Radioactive, and that would be my longtime gaming buddy, Lance Miller, who will be joining me to review Arkham Horror by Fantasy Flight Games. Lance is an avid board gamer. He played in my role-playing game campaign for years and still joins us from time to time. And he joins us. We also do monthly board gaming nights, and the last couple of nights have been dedicated to Arkham Horror. We've been playing this thing a lot, and we've been really enjoying it. So Lance agreed to join me and do a review. Just a few quick other notes on Lance. He's an avid PC gamer, particularly World of Warcraft. He is one of the guys who sucked me into it, although I haven't been playing Warcraft much the last couple of weeks, just, you know, with the baby coming home, and I just haven't had the time. But anyway, he's the principal guys who got me into World of Warcraft, and he's also a geek dad with a blog of his own, Ditlog, which is Day in the Life of a Gamer.
Back in the mist of time, before D20, before Doom, before Settlers of Catan, there were other games. Role-playing games like Top Secret and Traveler, video games like Dark Castle and Mule, and board games like Titan Cosmic Encounter, and Diplomacy. At the Vintage Gamer Podcast, we remember those times. In fact, we seek out great games from an earlier era. Each episode, we go back and take a fresh look at an older game that has stood the test of time, to see what works, see what doesn't, and spend a little time reminiscing. So grab your bottle of 30-year-old scotch or a piece of fine Stilton and join us at The Vintage Gamer, available at www.thevintagegamer.net.
Got a bunch of good stuff for Sites of Note this week. Now, Vintage Gamer was actually going to be one of them, but I haven't had a chance to actually listen to the podcast yet. I've looked over the blog, I've got it queued up, but I just haven't listened to it yet. So I'm planning on doing that later this week, and you can expect a more in-depth kind of review next time around. The first site I want to talk about this week, though, is a post that David Brin, who's a science fiction writer, posted to his blog, Contrary Brin, The Illusion of the Public Panic and the Power of the People. Now, I think I may have talked about David Brin a while back. Contrary Brin is a really cool site because it's David Brin's opportunity to just kind of, like, yank people's chains. And, I mean, it's not just cantankerous ramblings. I mean, he actually has a point, and he articulates it very well. But he takes some positions that, you know, some folks might find surprising, some people might find a little bit unsettling, depending on what end of the political spectrum you're at. And I think that he is able to alienate the extreme left and the extreme right extremely well with every other post. This particular post was... It was an interesting kind of thread, because it was talking about, first of all, why people didn't freak out and launch into a massive panic when September 11th happened. And then, together with this, he's talking about the trend in superhero movies lately, where common folks help out, they aid the hero. So, you know, Spider-Man is on the bridge battling Green Goblin, and they band together to distract Green Goblin, buying Spider-Man the time he needs to rescue Mary Jane, rescue the people who are dangling off the bridge, and then return to the fight with Green Goblin. So it was, it's a pretty cool little conversation, you know? I mean, the cool thing about, one of the great things about Brin is that he does not forsake his geek audience, and he's able to kind of wade into the whole sci-fi realm, into the comic book realm, and all of that. I do sometimes wish that he would spend more time working on new books than posting to Contrary Brin, because he obviously spends quite a lot of time thinking about these posts and coming up with his ideas and articulating them. And, you know, I'd love to see some of these things put into print again. His novel Earth was, I think, one of, you know, I guess he printed that in, I guess it was the 90s. I'll have to go back and double check. But Earth was kind of one of those big idea books where he kind of put in a lot of things he was thinking about. And I think it's time for Earth 2, where, you know, he returns maybe to that universe, or just returns to the concept of just articulating these ideas, but in novelized form. Because I think, by and by, it would be more appealing to people. I think sometimes it's easier to digest some of the stuff he's talking about when it's been fictionalized, and you can see the different characters' points of views rather than just going through, you know, a whole bunch of essays and the inevitable comment threads that, and the extensive comment threads that each of these blog posts usually spawns. So the link to the website for Contrary Brin is davidbrin.blogspot.com. I'll have a link to this particular story in the show notes. And one last note, if you're not familiar with David Brin, he's probably best known for Startide Rising and his Uplift trilogy. Actually, I guess it's more than that, because it's about six books now at this point. But that's what he's most famous for. But over the last couple of years, he's managed to raise more than a few eyebrows with his various essays. Now, next up, I wanted to let people know about Simpsons Mutants and Masterminds Amazing Character Builder, which is an exceedingly useful spreadsheet for building Mutants and Masterminds characters. And this is important because I am going to be doing a short Mutant Masterminds campaign sometime in the not-too-distant future, probably in 2007, early 2007, once my current urban fantasy campaign runs down. And this is one of those things that's just really useful to have around. The D&D equivalent of this would be Hero Forge, and it's basically doing the same kind of thing. It's making character creation a lot easier. Now, I found character creation in Mutants and Masterminds already to be pretty simple because it's kind of an a la carte. You go through and build what you want, buy what you want. But this streamlines the whole thing and just makes it much easier. The last site I wanted to talk about is kind of going a little bit deeper into the whole geeky podcasting thing, but it's the ID3 Tag Editor, which is a utility for editing ID3 tags in MP3 files, which is useful when iTunes just doesn't cut it. It's demoware, so you can try it for 30 days and then buy it for $9.50. I don't think I need to buy it at that price, but it's nice to know that it's around. I ran into some experiences at work where I had some files that the ID3 tags were just, they were just kind of screwed up. So the this program was able to just kind of clean up those problems right away, and the tags went back to being just fine. So if you're a podcaster and you're just confounded by problems with your ID3 tags, check this program out. It's pretty useful.
You must be listening to the Goblin Broadcast Network at gbn.com. Amazing!
All right, so next up, I'm going to be doing a review. Actually, not just me. Me and my friend Lance Miller are going to be doing a review of Arkham Horror, which is appropriate because it's Lance's game. So I'll give you the details real quick. Arkham Horror is a board game that was published by
Fantasy Flight.
It was originally published by Chaosium,
right? That's
right. Right. Okay. It was published by Fantasy Flight Games. It's for 1 to 8 players, ages 12 and up. They say the playtime is like 2 to 3 hours, and the MSRP is $50. So you may have just had a bit of sticker shock.
But you really get a lot for your money. This is one beefy ton of a game.
It is. It's a game that you put down on your table, and it just kind of thuds. But in a good way. So basically, here's the setup for what it is. Something terrible has come to Arkham. Actually, many terrible things have come to Arkham, and only intrepid and maybe a little crazy band of investigators can confront these horrors and prevent the summoning of the Great Old One, which is sure to destroy the town, if not the world. So, as the game begins, there are several portals to the Great Beyond that have opened, and monsters have begun to spill out into the streets of Arkham. These monsters are tied to horrific, mind-destroying Great Old Ones, the cosmic bad guys of H.P. Lovecraft's Cthulhu mythos. The exact Great Old One changes from game to game, and each Great Old One has its own influence on the world and has its own strengths and weaknesses and such. Players spend their time investigating the town, moving through the streets, shops, homes, and public buildings in an effort to defeat the monsters, find the portals that they are coming through, and magically seal them. But in order to do that, they have to go to the Outer Realms first, and it's a little bit more complicated than just waving your hands. If all the portals can be sealed in time, then the Great Old One won't come, but if the investigators fail, then he does, and
and basically kiss your butt goodbye.
And eats you. I think of the, like, what, 4 times we've played, we've
One win out of 4.
So, you know, we're not doing pretty good, too good, but it's very much in keeping with the Cthulhu mythos. So, the game pretty much plays like a Call of Cthulhu role-playing game translated into a board game, with each investigator having stats, abilities, and weapons.
I actually thought that was a real high point of it. For anybody that's played the Call of Cthulhu role-playing game, this game does an amazing job of emulating the feel of that RPG, even down to how you set up your characters and the flexibility that you have.
Yeah, it helps that I think Call of Cthulhu itself is fairly minimalistic, so it wasn't that huge of a leap to go to this even slightly more minimalistic approach. But players actually have the ability to buy new equipment, weapons, and spells as the game unfolds, and they will need them because everything out there is tougher and hungrier than you are. So that's basically the kind of the game in the nutshell. Anything else you want to add as far as setup?
The only thing that I would add was, you know, just a nod to the production value. I guess the original Chaosium game was probably a little bit lower on production value, paper counters and cardboard playing pieces and things like that. And these guys have pulled out all the stops. The board is beautiful. The cards are beautiful. We had one small gripe about the some of the event cards. Color doesn't exactly match those of the board, and you kind of have to pay attention to what you're picking up. But other than that, the artwork and the production value is just off the chart.
Yeah, because I mean, some games, if you spend $50 on it and you pick it up and you open up the box and you're kind of disappointed because you just spent $50 and you didn't necessarily get a lot. But with this game, you pick it up and you're like, Wow.
Yeah, the first time I brought it home and took the top off, I started taking things apart and pulling off the game board and everything, and the game was packed completely from the top of the lid to the bottom with stuff. There was no big airspace like you get in, you know, Monopoly or whatever. This thing is packed with pieces and cards and chits and rules and everything entirely to the bottom of the box. So you're definitely getting your money's worth.
And they say 2 to 3 hours to play this game, but the first time you play it, it's probably more like 4 to 5.
Yeah, it's got a learning curve.
It's probably got about an hour just to get it set up, get all the pieces assembled and into their respective decks and figuring out what you're supposed to do and just kind of going over the rules and
yeah,
all that.
I would call the learning curve 1 or 2 games. It, you know, the first time we played it, we, you know, really referenced the rules a lot. The second time we played it, we started to realize there were certain things we had to do if we actually wanted to, you know, win and things like that. But it, and actually even an art to getting it set up, because there are a lot of pieces.
Now, talking about the actual game and winning, this is kind of unique. Now, to give you a bit of setup for this, in our group, in our kind of gaming history, we kind of cut our teeth on like Illuminati and Munchkin and a lot of, well, fairly cutthroat games. And we could be fairly cutthroat when we play. So, and that was kind of like our relief from Dungeons & Dragons, where we kind of had at least the pretense of, we had the pretense of teamwork. But then, you know, play Illuminati, gets a little backstabbing. But anyway, every game we play, almost every game we've played, has been some sort of competitive game. Even like Settlers of Catan, which is a fairly benign game by our standards.
Which we somehow still turn into plotting and destruction.
Still ends up being, you know, fairly, you know, competitive. This game is a collaborative game. And you actually have to work together in order to win. And there's no way for an individual player to win. It's all like, do you as a group manage to defeat the bad guy? And my wife just said, you can play collaborative games? Yes, we can.
We can argue about what strategies we should take and pummel each other into obedience.
Of course, we can still argue about the rules, but and there was one other game we played, which was Vanished Planet, which was the only other collaborative game that we really had done. But so that really set this apart from the other stuff we played, and I think really kind of plays into the whole replay value thing.
And I think the game is difficult enough to win that it really gets you thinking about how can we work together well to defeat these bad guys, because it's really quite a challenge.
Right. You're spending, and that's, I think, the thing that remains is it's a collaborative game, but it's a fun and a challenging game. It's not, if you're thinking collaborative equals wimpy, not even close, because like I said, we've only won once out of 4 times.
So. And I think to some extent we pulled that out of our hat. You know,
right.
You know, there were some good rolls somewhere. There was a, you know, an amazing card, Holy Grail, that was pulled out of a deck somewhere. So
the replay value is further enhanced by there's 16 different adventurers. There's, I don't know, how many elder gods are there?
5 or 7.
So there's a lot of elder gods.
Right.
There's environment cards that get played during the game that kind of change what the settings are. So like there's a daylight card that weakens the monsters and makes it harder for us to sneak.
There are environment cards. There are rumor cards. The environment cards sort of persist until another environment comes out. The rumor cards are something that sticks around until some criteria has been met. And some of those are something that the investigators have to jump on immediately, and then or it'll immediately escalate into something worse.
And that's where the teamwork comes into play, because you're sitting there and you're playing the game, and you actually have to come up with what your strategy is like almost every turn. Because if you don't do it, you're just going to be.
Yeah, I'm over here and I'm tied up with this, so you guys have got to go and take care of that thing down in Smith Street or whatever.
Or he's trapped in the outer planes, and
I'm busy having my brain gelatinized. I think you guys should go over here and do this.
I think from our 4 play tests, it probably works best with 4 to 5 players, do you think?
The one time that we won, we played with 3, and it still seemed to scale fairly well. I think because of the way they've built the escalating level of threat, it actually paces the game pretty well, even for lesser players. But I do think that 4 or 5 is probably the sweet spot, and towards the top, things start becoming increasingly, maybe I should say geometrically, harder. You know, if you've got 7 or 8 players, you guys better be on your game.
Right, right. Because the number of monsters that appear are driven in part by the number of people that you have playing.
Yeah, there's a small chart in the back that says, you know, what the goals are and what the thresholds are. So you may have, I don't know, if there's 10 monsters on the board when you've got two people playing, everything's fine. But if there's three monsters on the board when you've got eight people playing, things start going to heck. So that sort of thing.
And the one thing that you were talking about before was the whole Doom and Terror Tracks thing.
Yeah, I like how this invokes the whole sense of escalating an impending doom from the fiction. You know, this feeling of hopelessness and an imperative to take care of this threat.
I'm going for a walk.
You're gonna go for right, this is my daughter Jordan.
Jordan's going for a walk because the elder gods are scary.
She's playing Nintendogs while we record this, so. All right, crisis solved. Jordan needed to walk her dog in Nintendogs, so.
There's even a physical manifestation of this whole escalating threat. You've got a Doom track that's sort of showing how soon the big bad guy comes out, and a Terror track that's showing how the populace is reacting to all these monsters popping out of ice cream carts and mailboxes all over the place. And then you've got the outskirts of the town, which is sort of where all the monsters go when there's too many monsters on the board, and that's showing escalation, and the monsters piling up inside the town. So it creates this sense of pressure or nervousness on the part of the players, and it keeps you really going.
Yeah.
It gets you emotionally involved with the game.
And, like, shops start closing down as the terror level rises, and it really feels like Cthulhu. I mean, it's Cthulhu just through and through. The skill sliders, we're talking a little bit about the investigators. It does feel like you're playing a character. I mean, there's not role playing involved in this, although I suppose there could be without much effort if you wanted to.
Yeah, you could look at it as a really light role playing kind of environment, like a computer role playing game or whatever. But one of the things that I thought was so great about the skill sliders was that you not only have a character sheet which is showing your player's attributes, from turn to turn you have to make a decision. There's three sliders with six opposing attributes, and in any given turn you have to move those sliders deciding what your character is going to be doing that turn, in a sense. So if you take a high skill in combat, well, you're going to be awful at sneaking, and you may get into the turn and realize, wow, I really needed to sneak.
And now I'm trapped out in the open after somebody just opened a couple of portals. And
so there's this great flexible mechanic, even on, you know.
You did.
And the walk is complete, and we have a present.
Woohoo! Thank you, Jordan.
What is it?
I don't know. How about you you go find out? Oh, you got a juice bottle. That's what you got. Keep going on your walk. This is the challenges of gaming with kids, guys. it's just a great game. I think it's probably one of our favorite games from our group. I mean, I probably rank it in the top three.
I mean, we usually get a big board game and we play it a couple of times and it loses its punch, and then we'll yank it back out after 6 months or so. But we've been, every single time when we've got enough people together to play a serious board game and we had, 3 hours to blow, everybody's been, okay, Arkham Horror.
You know,
we're not even pausing.
Right. It's actually, our other two big games are probably, as far as board games go, like Risk 2210 and
Settlers of Catan.
Or Cities and Knights of Catan. And it takes a lot to knock us off of our Settlers fixation, but yeah, this game did it.
Our Wood for Sheep is truly a driving force.
Right. So that's about it. You got anything else you want to add?
No, just, obviously we liked it, and we would recommend it. It's really deep and complex, but, it, by the same standpoint, you can get into it in a few hours. Just lots of replayability.
I think the one thing I did want to add is that this is a geeks game. This is, you gotta love board games, and you love Cthulhu. I don't know how much a casual gamer would appreciate this. It's not like a Carcassonne or a...
Yeah, the mechanic is a lot more...
Okay, and that was my German Shepherd, who had to add his little bit to the podcast. See, this is what happens when you record down in the dining room with an open mic. But
the fun at my house is always my 10-year-old son rooting for the ancient ones. You know, every half hour he comes in and wants to know if that old god ate us yet.
But like I was saying, I don't know if this is necessarily a game that non-gamers or it's casual board gamers would jump in.
It's not casual. The rule set's pretty complex. There's a lot to remember. I mean, we're avid board gamers, and we spent a little bit of time head scratching the first time we played.
Right.
But definitely recommended to the Lovecraft fans and the Call of Cthulhu fans out there.
I'm sorry, sir. We're about to close for lunch.
Lunch be damned. I'm looking for an important book whose very teachings will rend the veils between the worlds and bring forth great Cthulhu himself.
We have many books, sir. Also charms, sigils, filters, phylacteries and educational films, giant pandas...
A special and particular book. I seek the Unaussprechlichen Kulten of Wilhelm von Junz.
Goblin Press or Folio Edition?
Goblin Press.
Sorry, we don't have that, sir.
Folio edition, then.
I'm sorry, we don't have that either, sir.
Very well. How about the Cathat Aquadingen?
Just sold the last one today, sir.
Damn. What about De Vermis Mistress?
It's on back order, sir.
The Altdown Shards?
I'm sorry.
Revelations of Glarky?
9 or 12 volume edition.
Both? Any?
No, I'm afraid not, sir.
The Necronomicon?
It's awaiting reprint in paperback.
Well, what do you have, then?
Well, if you just care to walk through here into this dimly lit back room, sir, I'm sure you'll find something of interest.
Righty-ho. My lord, that's disgusting. No, stay away from me. Get off! No!
Oh well, I did warn him it was lunchtime.
Lovecraftiana, the little shop of cosmic horrors from Yogg-Sothoth. www.lovecraftiana.com.
So, folks, that'll about do it for this edition of Radioactive. Let me know what you thought, particularly, the whole guest format. If you liked it, let me know. If you didn't like it, let me know. If you want to be a guest, let me know, because I have a couple of different options there. I'm willing and able to experiment with, like, Skype or, more likely, iChat. And, I'd definitely be interested in trying to figure out how to do some of that stuff, because that's one of those projects that I've been thinking about forever but never really got around to. And now that the new site is done, I have some time. Lance and I will probably be doing some more reviews and just some more stuff that we've been kicking around, namely the Uncle Bear podcast project that I mentioned in Radioactive number 33. And I got a couple other things coming up, just a couple of other kind of guesty type things in mind. This is the 10th year of my gaming group, our 10th anniversary, and I've been thinking about recording a series of podcasts with the guys, just kind of... thinking, talking old war stories and looking back and looking into the future and just thinking about the group, because, 10 years for a gaming group is a pretty long time, and I think it's something that deserves to be commemorated in some way, But, so, that's it. If you have any comments, you can post them to the show notes for the show, which you can get to at www.nuketown.com. You can also email me at nuketown@gmail.com, and you can Skype me. The username is nuketown.